coming up.
How does a 36-year-old who's never worked in a job his daddy didn't buy become the second most powerful man in America, right behind Putin?
Was America really built on the promise that effort and ability are always rewarded?
One clue, your enrollment may not be entirely merit-based when your acceptance letter comes with a receipt.
Isn't America kind of a rigged system that rewards people for belonging to the right group?
I can clearly see this game is rigged, which is what's going to make it so sweet when I win this thing! Woo! You're sampling!
Don't the people at the top deserve their success?
Do the people at the bottom really deserve to be there?
Our guest is Joe Littler, author of Against Meritocracy. The Merits of Meritocracy.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. Shouldn't people be rewarded for their talent and effort?
Or should society treat us all the same?
Is meritocracy just a smokescreen for a system that's rigged?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. We're coming to you from our respective shelters in place via the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ray teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today, we're talking about the merits of meritocracy.
Meritocracy? Isn't that just a system that rewards the rich and punishes the poor?
It's the exact opposite. If we reward people based on merit, instead of family connections, or wealth, or good looks, then anyone can succeed.
That's a pretty story, Ray, but it's just not true. People who are born poor stay poor, especially in today's America. So much for the American dream.
Okay, so we don't have a meritocracy now, but wouldn't it be better if we did?
No. It would be massively unfair.
Wait, how could it be unfair to reward people for their skill and intelligence and hard work?
Well, how do you think they got to be skilled, intelligent, and hardworking in the first place?
Well, by a combination of inborn talent and seizing the opportunities in front of them.
Yeah, but they didn't choose their inborn talent, did they? And they didn't choose their opportunities either. When people start out with advantages they didn't choose or earn, does it really make sense to give them more?
Oh, hold on. So rewarding people for things that have nothing to do with talent is obviously unfair. But now you're telling me that rewarding people based on talent is also unfair? What exactly is fairness supposed to look like?
Well, fairness is all about equality, right? Everyone should get the same share of whatever society has to offer, no matter who they are or what advantages they were born with.
Okay, that seems great for distributing basic goods like housing and healthcare, but there are some things we just can't hand out to everybody. When you're looking for a doctor to perform open heart surgery, you don't just pick out someone at random. You pick someone who's good at their job.
Yeah, okay, but that doesn't have anything to do with what people deserve. If you wanted to pick the most deserving doctor, you'd probably choose the one who, overcame the most hardship or donated the biggest portion of their income to charity. But that's not what we do.
Fine, Josh. What's your vision of an ideal society? It sounds like you want us to live in that Kurt Vonnegut story. You know, the one where we level the playing field by injuring the most athletic and damaging the brains of the smartest.
Oh, no, I'm not talking about that kind of future. We shouldn't cut down people who are doing well. We should lift up people who are doing badly.
Because that's what they deserve?
Touché. Well, at least we can give some people a better chance of getting what they deserve. These days, many orchestras are tackling unconscious bias by doing blind auditions where aspiring musicians perform behind a screen.
So we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, behind the screen to find out more. She files this report.
Anthony McGill says when he first fell in love with music, he practiced the clarinet like an athlete training for the Olympics.
I liked sports. I grew up in Chicago when Michael Jordan was, at the height of the Bulls and those championships.
With classical music came a series of hoops to jump through and tests to pass. But as he got older, he learned more about how those hoops and tests were designed.
Those setups are made in a way that perhaps discriminate against certain peoples.
McGill went on to become the first African-American principal player in the New York Philharmonic, an ensemble that's been around since 1842.
As outsized as some of the opportunities that I've gotten to perform and to prove my merit, there are many people that have had complete opposite and negative experiences trying to prove their own worth and their merit within that system. And a lot of those stem from race.
According to a 2014 study, less than 2% of the players in top ensembles were Black. Less than 3% were Latino. Blind auditions, where musicians audition behind a screen, are an attempt to level the playing field. The idea took off in the late 60s when two Black musicians took the New York Philharmonic to court, arguing they had been discriminated against during the hiring process.
One of the things that orchestras started doing to correct this situation was to start holding auditions behind screens.
Anthony Tomasini is a New York Times classical music critic.
So that the identity of the person would not come into play.
But now Tomasini wants to get rid of blind auditions because he says there are still too few Black and Latino players in major orchestras, and identity should matter. Orchestras, he says, should reflect the community.
The idea of meritocracy in this case, that the very, very best players measured on some scale are the only ones who should be in an orchestra, I just reject that.
But others argue blind auditions are too important to abandon. In 1970, less than 6% of orchestra players were women. Now half of the New York Philharmonic is female.
The screen is an improvement over how they used to do it.
Carmen Limon is the principal flutist with the Wichita Symphony Orchestra, and she spent thousands of dollars on flights and hotel rooms just to show up for auditions.
In the flute world, most of the students and players are women. In the top orchestras, most of the principal flute players are men. Like, statistically, that doesn't make sense to me.
I've been very lucky. I had a series of really great teachers.
Michael Morgan is the music director of the Oakland Symphony and one of a small percentage of Black conductors in the country. He says so much of a person's classical music career is a combination of determination and happy accidents, and intentional funding for music education in public schools. He's been conducting since he was 12 years old.
My teachers were all so overqualified to be public school teachers that for them, it just made it more interesting to be able to teach things at a level that you would not normally teach in public schools.
That, he says, is where the quest to diversify orchestras needs to begin. And he says this is necessary for anyone who wants the classical music symphony to survive.
You do have to proactively work to diversify programming and artists and composers. And it doesn't happen accidentally. You have to actually work at it.
Donato Cabrera, music director for the California Symphony, agrees. In 2017, the California Symphony became the first orchestra to issue a public statement committing to diversity.
It's so easy to get hung up on the three Bs, Bach, Beethoven, and Brahms, and of course Mozart, and all the composers that we are also familiar with. But there is so much other repertoire that should be celebrated.
Now most orchestras have shut down due to the pandemic, but the movement for Black lives has forced people to pay attention and listen.
I truly believe you cannot fix what you do not measure.
Afa Dworkin is president and artistic director of the Sphinx Organization, a group founded to address underrepresentation in classical music.
I'd love to be here together in a year and say, wow, look at our presenting houses, at our orchestras today, and look at how far they've come and how far they say they still want to go.
After the killing of George Floyd, Anthony McGill, the principal clarinet chair for the New York Philharmonic, picked up his instrument. And then he closed his eyes, took two knees, and kneeled in silence. He posted this performance online and urged other musicians to pick up their instruments and play for justice and decency. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thanks, Holly, for that highly meritorious report. I'm Josh Landy. With me is my Stanford colleague, Ray Briggs, and today we're thinking about the merits of meritocracy.
We're joined now by Joe Littler, professor of social analysis and cultural politics at the City University of London, and author of Against Meritocracy, Culture, Power, and Myths of Mobility. Joe, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks for inviting me.
So Joe, we know you have an academic interest in meritocracy, but is there a personal story there as well?
Well, I guess I came from what you could call a mixed class background, in that half my extended family was quite comfortably middle class and the other half was extremely poor. So I think I saw firsthand how different types of equality and inequality could affect people's life chances, health outcomes, their ability to progress.
So people today think meritocracy is a good thing, but the ones who originally came up with the word meritocracy thought it was a bad thing. Can you tell us why that is?
That's right. So meritocracy as an idea has very long historical and wide geographical roots. So you might trace it, for example, to the idea of the American dream. You might trace it across to China and the idea of the imperial civil service. But when it was coined as a word, it was in the 1950s in England, and it was first used by an industrial sociologist, Alan Fox, who pretty much used it as a term of abuse. You know, he said, why would you heap prodigious economic benefits on the already gifted? It's just perpetuating inequality. And then it was popularized by Michael Young in his satirical book, The Rise of the Meritocracy, where he foresaw a future in which you had a trade in black market, grainy babies being swapped. So to begin with, it was a slur, it was a swear word. And for people like Hannah Arendt, the philosopher, it was problematic as well because it gestured towards inequality and the kind of educational stratification that was unfair. But then by the 1970s, when Daniel Bell, the theorist of the Information Society, took hold of it, he gave it a positive spin and thought, you know, well, why can't you have meritocracy as an engine of the knowledge economy? You know, he saw it as an unproblematically positive term. And this is the time when neoliberal capitalism in practice is really taking off. It becomes popularized by right-wing think tanks and then by people like Thatcher and Reagan and governments to really promote the idea that your life chances and your opportunities are down to you as an individual. They're not up to the wider social structures or safety nets. So today it's pretty much, I think, I would argue, an alibi for extreme inequality.
So how much through these changes did people view the word meritocracy as a word for something that was already happening? And how much did they view it as a word for something that might happen in the future and be good or bad?
I think it's always straddled the line between something that is thought to perhaps exist, but not quite. So it occupies this kind of fantasy space in which, you know, we know that there's not a level playing field. It's very clear, it's very apparent, and it's more apparent now, for example, it's more apparent at different times. And at the same time, it gestures towards kind of powerful ideas that we should be able to progress beyond where we are born. We should be able to develop ourselves in ways that we want to and that utilize our talents. And so I think it's you know, it's got kind of within its package of meaning, it's got very powerful components that are useful. But I also think that it's been used and packaged and sold to us very aggressively as a means to disguise extreme social inequality. And that's really ratcheted up over the past few decades.
What do you think is the engine of that ratcheting?
I think it's primarily political, but I think it functions as an ideological practice. So you can see it as a discourse, you know, as a kind of set of narratives that work through government rhetoric. It's used, for example, in the speeches of politicians from all shades in the spectrum. So it's used, for example, by Barack Obama, and it's also used by Trump in quite different ways, you know, whether authoritarian, populist or socially liberal. So it's used with different inflections politically. It's also promoted through our media. So, for example, we might think about how over the past couple of decades, reality TV shows that promote the idea of competitive individualism have really entrenched the notion that that life is a competition, you know, that work is a competition, that every single aspect of our lives is not about cooperation, it's about ruthlessness and about elbowing other people out of the way. So you just have to look at things like
America. I'm not here to make friends, right?
Yes, exactly.
I'm here to win $1 million. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about the merits of meritocracy with Joe Littler from the City University of London.
Is there a difference between being talented and just being lucky? Is it fair to reward people for their inborn advantages? Can anyone really know what other people deserve?
Rags, riches, and rightful rewards. When Philosophy Talk continues. Seems like Beyoncé deserves everything she's got. Is that because of, or in spite of, our supposed meritocracy? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, and we're thinking about the merits of meritocracy with Joe Littler from the City University of London, author of Against Meritocracy.
With COVID still in the air, we're pre-recording this episode, so unfortunately we can't take your phone calls. But you can always email us at comments@philosophytalk.org, or you can comment on our website, where you can become a subscriber to gain access to more than 500 episodes.
So Joe, in the opening, Josh was saying that meritocracy is unfair, and I was arguing that it's better than the alternatives, like giving out opportunities based on family connections or social class. So who's right?
Well, I think that, Ray, you are more right. But the problem is, with both of those stances, that meritocracy does function to perpetuate family contacts and nepotism. You only have to really look at Ivanka Trump to see that is still in evidence. But what it does at the same time is obscures these advantages. It obscures the kind of social structure and inequality that gives more advantages to some people than others, and instead promotes the idea that it's just down to you. All you need to do is work really hard and you can beat the odds. So because of that, I think it's deeply pernicious. You know, it's better than ingrained inequality. It's better than having an elite behind their golden gates of privilege, and that's how it gains its power. But it's by itself, it just works to shore up inequality.
But couldn't somebody say that precisely the problem with the current situation with Ivanka Trump getting the jobs that she's gotten is precisely that America isn't a meritocracy. It isn't living up to its own ideals right now. A left-wing advocate of meritocracy could say, look at the current government in the United States. It's plutocratic, it's kleptocratic, it's nepotistic. Let's try to live up to our meritocratic ideal. People should get what they deserve and not a position just because they're somebody's son or daughter. What about that?
Sure. I mean, it sounds very tempting, but the reality is that the word meritocracy has never existed outside of a social landscape of extreme inequality, economically speaking. That's the problem with it. The problem is that the measure of judgment and value that it implies is that when you reach the top, you get economic rewards, and those economic rewards are then given to the person's children. So there's some argument you could make there, for example, for, say, a socialist meritocracy. But it's not usually done because the word itself has become so toxic in its association with inequality, and particularly with neoliberalism over the past four decades.
I'm a little bit worried now that I agree that sort of the concept of meritocracy has arisen in a really unequal society, and that has potential to distort the ideal. But we live in a profoundly unequal society, and so any ideal we develop is going to be touched by that. How do we get around that? And is meritocracy somehow really ill-placed for getting around that?
Well, I think we do two things. Firstly, we disaggregate the different strands of meaning in the concept. And secondly, we use our creativity to identify progressive elements that have already existed. So to take the first bit, to disaggregate the meanings, could we have a society where people have equal access to develop and extend their skills to be recognized for them. Yes, that's completely possible. Can we have a meritocratic system structured around economic inequality? No, I don't think we can. So if we think about the kind of ideal element of that, where to look for progressive alternatives, there are plenty that are in existence. We just have to look, for example, at the kind of programs that were developed through the New Deal and through the welfare state in Europe, you know, things like public access to healthcare in Europe and free libraries, free education systems. Those are the kind of progressive alternatives that I think we can identify. And also there's a whole realm of other interesting, smaller, idiosyncratic examples around, for example, workers' co-ops, where people develop an idea and share their wealth and share the project together, as well as the really large-scale cooperatives that exist in places like Spain.
Yeah, so I'm seeing an equality of opportunity aspect to the concept of meritocracy and a, like, reward people for doing a good job aspect. And it sounds like you're questioning the reward people for doing a good job, so which makes a lot of sense. Like, I don't want to reward people with adequate food and housing for doing a good job, because I just think everybody should get adequate food and housing, regardless of whether they get a good job. Is there a value to, like, marginally rewarding people a little bit for doing a good job? Should we just scrap that altogether?
That's tricky. I think perhaps you could think about it in terms of progressing with skill. It's possible, but it should be relatively negligible, I think. And you have to take into account people's situations, the way, people's dependents, for example, the cost of living in their area. So there are some really interesting kind of progressive workers' co-ops where they take those things into account when they're paying out the salary of people.
I think this is a really interesting, I like that example. I think it's a really interesting and difficult question. The objection that's usually raised is if you had a completely equal system in the sense that everyone made exactly the same amount of money and got exactly the same other kinds of non-financial rewards, then how are you going to motivate people to work and to work harder and so on and so on? I mean, that's one way to phrase the objection. Another is, won't it start to feel unfair, right? We're worried about the unfairness of meritocracy. Mm-hmm. The worry on the other side is, would a system of not just equal opportunity, but equal outcome, everyone gets paid exactly the same and gets the same housing and the same other kinds of rewards, wouldn't someone feel, hey, you know, that person over there is a bit of a freeloader. I'm doing all the work. It's like, you know, a high school project where one person's actually doing all the work in a collective project. And they go, hey, wait, we all got the same grade, but I did the experiment. So if we're worried about fairness, why not just say we'll keep a little bit of income disparity, but we'll reduce it massively. Right now, a CEO at an S&P 500 company makes like 300 times the median salary of the employees. Let's reduce that to twice or 1.5 times. So there's still a little bit of disparity, but not this glaring inequality. What about that? What about that as a possible vision?
Well, I think you're right in that the argument against it often tends to get made on the basis of nitpicking, you know, and it's so far removed from the reality. You know, think about the difference in divergence in income between Elon Musk and a nurse. It's just off the scale. It's off the chart. Yeah. And so what we need to do is to radically reduce that extreme inequality. That is the priority. But I think we also need to think about what people are motivated by. And they're not necessarily motivated by vast wealth at all. They are when they're living in situations of extreme precarity and money becomes extremely important because you haven't got it, you haven't got enough. But otherwise, we're motivated by other things. You know, we're motivated by looking after people. We're motivated by extending our ability and be able to progress and do new things, you know, acquire new skills. It's kind of its own reward. So I was of the generation in the UK, for example, that had free university education.
Me too. Yeah.
That's good, right?
Yes, yes.
And now we have this extreme inequality, this extreme intergenerational inequality between my generation and those that came after me. And what's interesting is that a lot of them, you know, some students find it hard to understand, you know, how they would necessarily work hard if you didn't pay for it, as though paying for it somehow is in itself the reason why you do it, the reason why you would have to work. But we were interested in the subject because the subject itself was inherently interesting, you know, because we wanted to learn. Learning itself became its own reward. So I think we need to open up our imaginations and uncouple them from the idea that monetary reward itself is all-encompassing.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about the merits of meritocracy with Joe Littler from the City University of London. And we have an email from G. Mangle, who says, I think the purpose of meritocracy as an ideology is not only to give elites a way to feel like they earned their prosperity, perhaps of equal importance, says G. Mangle, is that it blames and shames those who are trapped in poverty by mechanisms of racial and class-based oppression. The implicit and explicit shaming of the disadvantaged for their situation helps keep them from recognizing the systemic obstacles that function to keep them on the edge. So what do you think about that, Joe?
I think it's absolutely true. It's completely and utterly true. So it is the case that people are encouraged to blame themselves when they don't succeed. And it's often people who are, you know, the furthest removed from the bottom rungs of the ladder of social progress who are most intensely incited to climb it and who are most intensely blamed when they you know, most of them fail to. And instead you have these small examples of people moving upwards and progressing in stereotypical terms, but are picked out by the media, which are made what I call parables of progress, are made luminous, these examples that are spotlighted, while the rest are shamed.
So this is a kind of a part of the idea of meritocracy that I don't think is either about equality of opportunity or about rewarding people for doing good work, which is the idea that if you get a reward, you are somehow a more worthy person, which I think like both you and this email by G. Mangle picked up on. Where does that come from? So I don't want to ask if there's anything to that because I don't think that there's much to it, but where does it come from and how do we get rid of it? That's not a too prejudicial way to put the question.
Well, again, I think it comes back to the way in which the ideology of meritocracy has been pegged around different economic rewards and economic inequality. So it's very comforting for the rich to believe that they deserve their wealth, and that they worked hard to gain what they got. So it's very common when you look at the biographies of billionaires, the autobiographies of billionaires, or media interviews, for people to say, you know, Ivanka Trump, for example, to say, well, you know, it's not just that I got given everything. I also worked hard. My parents made sure that I earned it. I deserved it. And it offers comfort, doesn't it? Because it means that you don't have to think about the inequality that exists and, you know, whether the rewards themselves are structurally problematic.
We've got another email, which is relevant to this, from Henry Rutkowski. Who says, what level of wealth and privilege does a particular merit class deserve? And how can the distribution of rewards yield an optimal society instead of generating large wealth differentials?
Well, I think we have to, you know, think about leveling the playing field for real. You know, we have to think about, for example, you know, should billionaires exist? Why can't we ban billionaires? And, you know, surely a millionaire is enough. We need to think about universal basic services that mean that people aren't, you know, struggling to achieve, that are a million miles away from any notion of the ladder. And I think we need to, you know, kind of reinstate the idea in popular narratives that it's not all about individual competition, it's about social cooperation. And you see the value of that right now in these times of the pandemic.
I totally agree with that. I guess what I was wondering is whether there's a danger of extrapolating from our own local situation. So obviously, Ray and I are living in 2020 America, enough said. You are living in Boris Johnson's United Kingdom. But what if we look to the Scandinavian model, for example, where you know, there's free healthcare, free education, great access to daycare. Isn't there room to think that there could be a model of meritocracy that is actually progressive and maybe not perfect, but decent?
I think the Scandinavian model is great in many ways. It's got lots going for it. And it's, you know, it's been a fantastic example that people all over the world point to. It's also one that's under threat from the forces of neoliberalism. And it really goes to show how politics of one nation state can't just be made better on their own, how we're all interconnected. And it also shows, I think, some of the difficulties of the kind of compromises of mid-century social democracy, strong and important as they were. So I think we need to, you know, think, for example, about, you know, who was excluded from those welfare models. They were welfare models that were built around white men in particular, particular kinds of social structures that didn't necessarily advantage people of colour and women to the same extent. And we also need to think about how to make organisations that aren't capitalist organisations stronger. So how would you kind of increase the power of cooperatives in a libertarian and not an authoritarian way? So I think there's plenty of historical examples that are good, but we also need to think about their problems in order to think about what kind of libertarian socialism perhaps might look like.
I want to read an email by one more listener, Edward A. Francisco, who asks, "No meritocratic system can be completely attainable or fair if being fair is meant to preclude unearned differences. Not being fully attainable and not being completely fair are not prima facie reasons to reject a meritocratic system, since those standards are unreasonably high for any defensible social system." So I guess that was more of a comment than a question, but do you have a response for Edward's email?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are elements of meritocracy which are really positive. I would always say that. I think that we need to think about how we can progress and develop ourselves. We need to think about how we can move beyond systems of elitism and ingrained privilege. Those are all really important and powerful ideals to hold on to. But at the moment, meritocracy has come to function as a smokescreen for the vested interests of the hyper-privileged. And it doesn't work. It's structurally impossible. It's an obfuscatory kind of mantra, if you like, that is designed to make plutocrats look like they're normcore and everyday, but aren't. And as such, it works to extend the kinds of inequalities that we have and reproduce them rather than tackle them. So I think we really need to think about inventive, creative ways in which we can create a level playing field that is also, you know, think about the field itself. So think about how we can connect to ideas like the Green New Deals and cooperation and care to look after each other rather than just ourselves.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about the merits of meritocracy with Joe Littler, author of Against Meritocracy.
Don't we all deserve to be happy? Or do we just deserve the right to pursue happiness? How can we have equal opportunities when we're starting from such different places?
Getting what we deserve, when Philosophy Talk continues. What do you deserve for being the best around? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs. Our guest is Joe Littler from the City University of London, and we're thinking about the merits of meritocracy.
So Joe, with the power vested in us by American Public Radio, we're going to appoint you Czar of Opportunity. So what's the first thing you do as Czar to make sure everyone gets a genuinely equal shot at success, regardless of their starting position?
How exciting, what power. Well, I guess I would fuse two. I would ban billionaires and redistribute their wealth. And with some of that money, I would fund free education for all throughout everyone's lifetime.
This brings us to another email, actually, about universities. So Andrew Davis asks, I want to question the assumption that the best universities should be reserved for the best students, especially since determining who are the best students is impossible. He says, I'd love to hear this hashed out.
Yeah, well, I mean, universities are a fascinating topic in relation to meritocracy, and there's been some wonderful work done, particularly in the States, on this subject. So Lani Gounier's work on the tyranny of the meritocracy kind of picks apart the history of Harvard admissions and looks at how it's worked to serve different racist agendas, basically. And you can just look to the kind of scandals that have erupted in recent years, whether it's schools like T.M. Landry, I think it was, where underprivileged black students were basically subjected to a regime of abuse. And they falsified narratives in order to get into Ivy League schools, the people that ran it, whilst kind of taking loads of money off them, all the way up to the kind of transcript scandals of recent years. So, yeah, universities are deeply problematic in that sense, but precisely because they're pegged around the system of extreme inequality, which doesn't help people progress and it doesn't give everyone an equal shot.
So I also wonder about how you can make universities fair without making pre-secondary education more fair. So in the US, sort of school funding is attached to local property taxes, which means that the rich areas get much better school funding than the poor areas. And then you have sort of parents pulling their kids out of public schools to send them to private schools and being very competitive. How do you sort of equalize higher education without equalizing sort of earlier education first?
Well, there's different ways that you can think about this, aren't there? Because they're the kind of ideal scenarios and then they're the tweaks to the system. You know, I don't live in the States, so I wouldn't want to comment too much on it. But in Britain, where I am, we are kind of fast hurtling towards a system of extreme segregation that replicates the States in many ways at all levels. So the idea of charter schools are kind of replicated in secondaries here with academy schools. So the kind of systems of privatization and marketization and kind of removing the vestiges of the welfare state education provision are increasing every year. And I think to tackle the problems, we need to reverse that process, and you need to think about what it would look like to have good educational provision in local communities from cradle to grave, you know, including adult education.
Yeah, look east to Scandinavia, not west to the United States. But we have another email, which is a really interesting suggestion. So this is from David Milgram. When a company develops a set of job requirements and invites applications based on them, would it not be effective and ultimately fairer to select randomly among all those applicants that satisfy the job requirements, assuming the job requirements themselves are fair? What do you think about that? You know, assuming you meet the minimum threshold, then it's a lottery.
Well, you know, you have to look at how it worked in practice. I think suggestions like that, they kind of get at the problem in quite a partial way. So it actually reminds me of the issue of blind auditions that you started with earlier on the program. And if you have blind auditions for orchestras, yeah, it screens for ability, you know, performance without discrimination, but it doesn't really show you who has access to, say, a clarinet, to learning and practicing and playing that musical instrument through time. So I think, you know, we need clear job criteria. We need clear anti-discrimination policies. And we also need to think about who is being able to apply for these jobs and why.
That's a really good point, right? If you think about who's going to get in the door for that audition, it's not just who has talent or has worked hard. It's also who had access to a clarinet when they were a kid, who's parents had time to practice with them or teach them or care about them and all that stuff, right? And so it's a much broader systemic question. But I guess a question I had for you, Joe, is when you think about meritocracy, I wonder whether our intuitions don't vary depending on which way we think about it. Because if you think about it as rewarding an individual, then it starts to seem very suspicious. Why should I reward this individual who probably got a lot of their advantages in ways that had nothing to do with them. But if you think about it as filling a job, then, right, who should be, you know, the chief surgeon at this hospital? Probably whoever's best, you know. Who should we hire into this orchestra? Well, probably whoever's the best clarinetist. So do you think our intuitions diverge depending on whether we're thinking about a set of positions to be filled and then picking the person, or whether we're thinking about a set of people and then what those people deserve?
I think you have to disaggregate it again and think about the job and the function and the way in which people can learn on the job. So for example, you know, thinking about employing a secretary to work with a team, you could think about how positive discrimination is relatively easy way to increase the diversity of a team without too many problems. Yeah. If you're thinking about appointing a neurosurgeon, you obviously need someone that's really well qualified. But that doesn't mean you can therefore throw out all issues of diversity. You just have to look back further and see, you know, who has had the ability to train as a neurosurgeon and why. So it involves tackling the problem at a different scale, a different place in the system, more obviously, I think.
So it occurs to me that the rewarding sort of skill and effort aspect of meritocracy and the equal opportunity aspect of meritocracy actually come apart, and sort of not only are they distinct, but they seem like they're in tension with each other. Because if you give somebody the reward of like extra money or extra leisure time, they will do things like spend those resources on their children and giving their children better opportunities than the children around them. So do you think that that's an aspect of human beings that can be managed or changed? Like if we give differential rewards for anything, how do we stop them from building up?
Well, you just have to look at different ways in which societies have organized themselves through history to know that we can organize ourselves in very different ways. And the kind of potential now for people to build up vast reservoirs of money, if they're a billionaire, for example, and hand that on to their kids, is very different from how it was, say, 60 years ago. So it's completely possible to think about disaggregating economic reward from people's potential, and to think more capaciously about different types of social reward, including extending our abilities, working together to produce a kind of society that we want to see that seems healthy and is more democratic and well-functioning.
I mean, I take all these points, you know, and I definitely worry too about meritocracy functioning as a smokescreen, right? People will vote against their own economic interests. They'll vote for tax cuts on the super rich because they think one day I'm going to be that billionaire. And that seems exactly right to me. But I guess I've also seen phenomena like Barack Obama. You mentioned Obama earlier as somebody who spoke in favor of a meritocratic vision of America. But he's someone who the Council of Economic Advisors said oversaw the largest increase in federal investment to reduce inequality since the Great Society through things like the Affordable Care Act. Obviously, things are still far from perfect. It's, you know, very much a work in progress. But isn't there a left-wing version of meritocracy that every now and again makes at least a little bit of a difference?
Well, I wouldn't call it meritocracy necessarily. I think Obama's gains, it's a more socially liberal version of meritocracy, which is obviously a million miles better than Trump's racist authoritarian populism. But at the same time, it works to endorse neoliberal inequality at an extreme level. And so that the problem wasn't tackled. So I think there are, you know, elements of that that we can take forward, but we have to really do the work of decoupling. Work of decoupling economic reward from social progress. Social progress isn't elbowing other people out the way up the ladder to get to the top. You know, social progress is creating a functioning democratic society where everyone can flourish.
So Joe, on that note, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a really inspiring and enlightening conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Our guest has been Joe Littler, professor of social analysis and cultural politics at the City University of London, and author of Against Meritocracy, Culture, Power, and Myths of Mobility. So Ray, what are you thinking now?
So it's very clear that we don't live in a meritocracy right now. And I'm persuaded by Joe's skepticism about meritocracy being a good enough ideal. It seems to run too many things together, including this idea of competitiveness and only rewarding some people. I think I want to know more about like what my alternatives are among other ideals.
Yeah, right, exactly, because we all want fairness, right? And I guess at the end of the day, it's going to come down to what does that actually look like? We want the best people in the jobs that we need done, and we want people to get sort of what they deserve, but in how to get that to actually pan out?
And we want equality, but then equality of what?
Equality of what and how, and what all do we need to change in our society to get there? But this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner, your online community of thinkers, where our motto, with apologies to Descartes, is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner in the community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature it on the blog. Now, did he get so fast by effort, or was he just born that way? It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, our national sadness over the dwindling of a perceived meritocracy is misplaced. Have we ever been good at what we do? We're not that good at thinking ahead. Thanks to the genius of Henry Ford and the brilliant assembly line, I guess, we all own cars, making a huge industry, freeways, vast parking garages and lots, insurance, smog, seatbelt laws, exploding Pintos, Ralph Nader, the fall of Detroit, global warming. So how smart was Henry Ford, really? Tear down the statues of Henry Ford. Rename the schools, the street, walk home. We also look at President Trump, or some do, as proof that boneheaded incompetence now knows no measure. Nah, he's part of a proud tradition. And the new trend is actively against meritocracy, making it hard to vote. So you won't have qualified people running, making it hard to get an education, and a crappy one if we do. So America becomes greedy blind mice leading a nation of nervous blind mice trying to tuck us all into a cabin ownership. What could go wrong? Also, our leaders seem to want us not to wear a mask in the presence of airborne fatal diseases because, it'll come to me. Because freedom, that's right, because of freedom. We're supposed to be educated through a common culture, but that's been whittled away. We don't have anything in common anymore except a vast reservoir of stupidity. Conservatives like to blame liberals for the decline in education. It's postmodernism putting the kibosh on common sense. Jefferson was racist. Robert E. Lee were racist. Tear down the statues and don't read about them. You'll get infected. There's that. But also conservatives made us hate our own history by clinging to outmoded information delivery systems, writing cursive with a pencil, memorizing rhyming poems about Abraham Lincoln. Have we learned nothing from capitalism? Well, in fact, there's only one thing to learn from capitalism. Buy or get out of the way. So, sitting in rows in a classroom, gone. History books and magazines, gone. And while it's true that we are toppling the statues of all kinds of formerly revered figures, what do you expect? And they keep denying the evil elements of your own heritage. Other nations don't have this trouble. Richard III, for example, as Shakespeare depicts him, was kind of a ruthless guy who killed his way to the top. Yet England did not expunge him from its list of kings. We hate science now because it will force us to clean up the planet, costing money. Also, science made atom bombs, which scare us, and we have computers now. Why do we even need science? Well, to make apps, I guess, but we're kind of scraping the barrel there. My phone can tell me how to get to Burlingame in a voice like Meryl Streep. I can use it to pay for parking so I don't have to lug quarters around. Wow, boring. The only science we all like is forensics. That's because true crime is the only television we like. Where would justice be without Luminol? Blood-free and knee-deep in murder, my friends. The only place I see any evidence of learning is QAnon, the extreme conspiracy theory cult. They believe Hillary Clinton and Tom Hanks are part of a global cannibalistic pedophile cult, I think. President Trump is secretly in charge of bringing it all down, which I don't quite get. If he's the most powerful man in the world, why did he just executive order the behinds into prison? The point is, QAnoners follow the posts of Q, a top-secret mole in the great swampy workings of the U.S. government. These posts are numbered and called drops. There are thousands. Drop 577, drop 4789. Gather them up. Put them in a Bible. It's the only book you'll ever need. For verily, as Q said in drop 3898, or drop 3, now think about the timing of POTUS traveling to China. I've said too much. God bless, patriots. Bring it on, says QAnon. Let's go to war with China, Antifa, and each other. The letter Q is supposedly a top secret clearance the anonymous poster has. But there's no way for us to know, because it's top secret. He could have just given that clearance to himself, because without a clearance, would we believe him? So, believe him. QED. Create your own truth and let us lie in it. We'll decipher the secret messages like Ralphie and Christmas Story and await the day. Wake up, sheeple. Your real-world expertise is for naught. On the other hand, I knew a guy in college whose only skill was, though perpetually stoned, he could recite all of Elvis Presley's movies in order and year released. I imagine he even found a future for himself once the drugs wore off. In other words, it's all good. It's all wisdom. All directions work. Every east is eventually west. Just keep stumbling along. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2020.
Our executive producer is Tina Pamantuan.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Angela Johnston, and Lauren Schechter.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed, or misexpressed, on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
The freedom of it, the fairness, hits, likes, comments, these were the things that made YouTube great and pushed the best people to the top. It was a meritocracy.